right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Michael Brown reporting. At this hour, thousands of people are gathering for the March for Our Lives demonstration rally here in Washington, hoping to gain momentum for changes in gun laws. More than 800 sister marches have been planned in each of the 50 U.S. states and worldwide. Jennifer Smith, an American who lives in Australia, is an organizer of the March for Our Lives demonstration in Sydney.
The biggest thing that I've learned here, and this is more personal, is I can breathe easy. When I send my kids to school, I never have to worry about them having to do active shooter drills. I don't have to worry about active shooters. And we still have family and friends across the United States. And that's my hope for all of them, that everybody, whether you're a student attending school or just a concert goer, that you don't have to fear for your life. And unfortunately, that's the reality of it right now.
The student organizers of the march are demanding that children's lives become a priority here in the U.S. They're also demanding an end to the epidemic of mass school shootings. A powerful 6.3 magnitude earthquake struck the island of New Britain and Papua New Guinea on Saturday. Seismologists said there was no tsunami warning, that is, or immediate reports of damage. The Pacific nation was hit with a 7.5 magnitude quake on February 26 that buried homes, triggered landslides in its highland region, killing at least 125 people. South Korea announced Saturday that North Korea has agreed to meet next week to coordinate logistics and agendas for an inter-Korea summit to be held in April. Each side will send a three-member team Thursday to the border truce village of Panmunjom. The April summit between the two leaders comes as President Trump expected to meet Kim Jong-un in May. This is VOA News. The Islamic State has claimed responsibility for shooting and hostage-taking incidents in southern France, in which four people were killed. The French Interior Minister says the French police officer who exchanged himself for hostages held by a gunman has died. Get more on the story from VOA's Philip Alexia.
The attacker first fired six shots at police officers on their way back from jogging near the city of Carcassonne. The police were not in uniform, but were wearing athletic clothes with police insignia. One police officer was shot in the shoulder, but the injury was not serious. The suspect then went to a Super U supermarket in a nearby small town, taking an unknown number of people hostage. After an hours-long standoff, police then stormed the supermarket. Interior Minister Gerard Collomb confirmed that the suspect had been shot dead and three other people were killed. Philip Alexio, VOA News.
China is condemning the United States for what it calls a serious political and military provocation after a U.S. warship entered waters near an island claimed by Beijing in the South China Sea. A spokesman for the Chinese Defense Ministry said the U.S. had seriously harmed China's sovereignty and security. U.S. Navy destroyer USS Mustin on Friday sailed close to the Chinese island in the South China Sea on what it called a freedom of navigation operation. It was then warned to leave the waters by two Chinese Navy ships. U.S. President Donald Trump has issued an order banning most transgender people from serving in the military, except under limited circumstances. The White House says the Secretaries of Defense and Homeland Security have concluded the retention of individuals with a history of gender dysphoria presents considerable risk to military effectiveness. Gender dysphoria, formerly known as gender identity disorder, is defined by strong, persistent feelings of identification with the opposite gender. Criticism of the renewed effort towards a gender ban was immediate from politicians, human rights groups, and the LGBT activists. President Trump's latest pick for the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, says the United States cannot walk away from the war in Afghanistan because of the larger threat from the Taliban, the Islamic State, and al-Qaeda. Bolton's views are ensuring the Taliban is degraded square with President Trump's Afghan strategy announced last August. I'm Michael Brown, reporting here in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Then Monday, of course, waiting for 12 o'clock is still going to create a kind of cloud over the city of Freetown itself.
The Sierra Leonean High Court places an injunction on Tuesday's presidential election runoff.
Everybody is alive, and we greet everybody, and we sing and dance after the victory of democracy in Togo. Triumph of democracy in Togo. That's what we want.
Ghanaian president meets with Togolese groups to jumpstart peace talks aimed to resolve Togo's political crisis.
It is political junk, and they know for a fact that President Lungu can account for his words, and they are not dealing with someone who's just come from the blues.
And Zambia's main opposition party files a motion in parliament seeking to impeach President Edgar Lungu. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The Sierra Leonean High Court has today put an injunction on the conduct of the country's presidential election runoff scheduled for Tuesday, March 27. The ruling on Saturday prevents the National Electoral Commission from organizing the runoff vote. Acting as a citizen and voter, Ibrahim Sori Koroma, a lawyer and former parliamentary candidate under the ruling All People's Congress, petitioned the court against the Electoral Commission, requesting an injunction on the presidential runoff election, forensic audit of the entire vote count, among others. To learn more about the court ruling, I reach Andrew Koroma, an independent journalist in the Sierra Leonean capital, Freetown.
The originating motion was actually made on the 21st of March, that was this same week, and then the court was adjourned to today. So in today's ruling, the High Court judge actually asked for questions, and because there are no questions, he then adjourned the case for the first and second defendants, that's the National Electoral Commission as second defendant, and then the first defendant, that's the commissioner of the Electoral Commission himself. They have to appear again in court on Monday at 12 to ask any questions, and then after that, the judge will decide whether to go ahead or not to go ahead.
Andrew, if I may ask you,
yes.
As it stands now, does that mean that Tuesday's presidential election runoff will not come on as originally scheduled by the Electoral Commission?
Well, the court did not say so, but his ruling, he said he was restraining the first and second defendants from conducting the presidential election scheduled for March 27, 2008, pending the hearing and determination of his court, that is on Monday. So just read in between the line, interim injunction restraining the first defendant and the second defendant. The first defendant is the Electoral Commissioner himself. The second defendant is the National Electoral Commission as a commission from conducting the presidential election scheduled for the 27th until he makes a decision on Monday. Now, you know the court sits at 12 between Monday and Tuesday. That's not much enough time. Already we are having problems with NEC posting people to the various election polling stations. And just imagine from Monday at 12, you will have to determine whether the election can actually go ahead on Tuesday at 6 o'clock in the morning. You have to... Monday is a very, very critical day. Now, if you restrain NEC, that means Monday being a very critical day for all polling centers to be ready, we'll still be on hold up to 12 o'clock. When can we have all these polling centers ready before Tuesday? That's the big question now.
Now, Andrew, some people are saying that this ruling creates a lot of confusion and will possibly raise tension in Freetown and other parts of the country. What is your assessment on the ground?
Well, I tell you, just in few minutes, a while ago, you could see that the message just spread like wildfire across the country.
and it is really a tense situation. The same question you raise is what people are raising, that this decision, we have to determine the peace of Sierra Leone as it is now. Just like this, like the question you put to me, it is putting people in doubt as to whether the election will be held on Tuesday. Already, right after the election, place was met with violence, hate speech, tribal speeches moving all around. So imagine the two political parties are really, really tense to go in for the election on Tuesday. And then hearing this information coming out today, Saturday, tomorrow, Sunday is going to be very chilling in the country. And then Monday, of course, waiting for 12 o'clock is still going to create a kind of cloud over the city of Freetown itself.
Some people are worried that with the ruling, if the election runoff is not held on Tuesday, it could also create a constitutional crisis because the Electoral Commission, they said, was following the constitutional stipulations on when to hold elections runoff when it happened. Secondly, they are also complaining about the fact that a lot of money were used for the campaigning of these two main political parties ahead of Tuesday's election. So monies are also being wasted. Foreign poll observers are in the country. They have to use all these monies if elections are not held on this Tuesday. What are you hearing on the ground, Andrew?
It's a constitutional matter. And, of course, once you have to do with constitutional matter, it must be dealt with. It must be interpreted. The public must be able to understand the interpretation of the court. Now, today, Saturday, as we're speaking, there is still campaign going on. That means a lot of money is spent on the election. Even with our local organizations or media organizations, we've spent a lot of money. And you remember, the country is still under austerity measures. And our election is being supported by the government solely and not by international community. So you can tell that if the election is not actually held on Tuesday, it means a lot to the preparation for another election.
Andrew Koroma is a Sierra Leonean independent journalist. He spoke with me from Freetown. Meanwhile, former Sierra Leonean Vice President Sam Sumane's opposition party, Coalition for Change, or C4C, says it will not endorse any of the two presidential candidates for the runoff vote. Former military ruler Brigadier Julius Maada Bio from the Sierra Leone's People's Party, or SLPP, faces former Foreign Minister Samura Kamara from the ruling All People's Congress, or APC, in the runoff poll. Both candidates failed to garner the 55% threshold constitutionally required to win the first round of the vote. For more about the decision not to endorse any of the candidates, I reached Lawrence Coker, spokesman for the opposition C4C in the Sierra Leonean province of Kono.
First of all, he has given the people of Kono an opportunity to stay neutral. So he's really given them 2.5 choices. Let's maintain our neutrality. And choice number 2 is go for either or, one or the other.
Some critics are saying that that was disingenuous of the former vice president to ask his supporters either to stay neutral or vote for one of the two presidential candidates of the two main parties, because he campaigned for change. He campaigned that the status quo should not remain, and that it is obvious that his support should be given to the SLPP presidential candidate, Julius Maada Bio, because both of these presidential candidates stood on the platform of change of the ruling APC. How do you respond to that?
Well, what I would say to that is those who believe that it was ingenious do not know the entire history of politics in Sierra Leone. In the same way that people voted for change or campaigned on a platform of change, they also campaigned on a platform of getting rid of the SLPP itself, because the majority of the people in Sierra Leone believe that the ills in Sierra Leone can be attributed to the leadership, the rule of these two parties over many, many years since independence. So ultimately, what we have found doing research within the members of the Coalition for Change is that some people, depending on their age, some people remember the days of the SLPP bringing what they considered to be bad things to Kano. Those of recent times would remember, they recall what the APC party have perpetrated on Kano, such as the sacking of, the illegal sacking of the Vice President Chief Alhaji Samsumana. So it was one of those decisions that with research, we found that the party itself was split. It makes a lot of sense in that scenario. I think it is exemplary leadership to then actually go to the people who are going to be mostly affected, the people who have created the power base that Chief Alhaji Samsumana has now through the C4C party. And those are the people in Kano. So these deliberations have taken place at the highest level.
Where is the former vice president, the presidential candidate for the Coalition for Change, stand now? Independently, is he endorsing any of these two candidates in the run-up to the elections on Tuesday?
In his pronouncement today, the 23rd of March 2018, Chief Alhaji Samsumana, in a town hall meeting, made it clear that he has put this decision to prayer, but he has not come to a conclusion. The conclusion that he has so far is that he needs to consult his people, and that is where he stands today. He will have a view. Come next couple of days, that view will be expressed at the same time that the rest of the community will have an opportunity to express their view. Based on that consultation, Chief Alhaji Samsumana will then give a final pronouncement, which will be expected of any leader. Even though all these consultations are going to happen, clearly we're going to have divergent views, like I've said already. Some of the older generation remember the SLPP doing things that are wrong to the party. Those of a much younger generation, given what happened recently to the elected vice president, they have issues with the All People Congress. A lot of people in Sierra Leone, like you have alluded to, Peter, they believe that when a runoff comes along, you should plumb for either. So ultimately, somebody is going to be disappointed. A group of people are going to be disappointed because you cannot serve all those different purposes at the same time. That is where leadership, again, will come in. I believe that Chief Alhaji Samsumana will take into consideration everything that would have been said, all the deliberations that would have gone on, and leadership will be shown at the point where he makes a pronouncement as to where he believes the followers of the Coalition for Change, the C4C party, should go.
Lawrence Coker is the spokesman for the Sierra Leonean Opposition C4C party. He spoke with me from Kano.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
Welcome back. Still in West Africa, Ghanaian President Nana Addo-Dankwa Akufo-Addo met representatives of the opposition and the Togolese government in the capital Lomé Friday. The meeting aimed to jumpstart negotiations between the two groups to end the political crisis in Togo. This after disagreement between the government and the opposition led the postponement of the dialogue last month. Some opposition supporters are demanding that President Faure Gnassingbé resigns immediately. However, supporters say the president will not resign. For the latest development about the dialogue, I reach Kojo Marcos Dima, a leading member of the National Alliance for Change, or ANC, a Togolese opposition party.
We have a session today, you know, sponsored as usual by President Nana Akufo-Addo. Now, we cannot tell anything except forecasting a good result for everybody.
So what are your expectations of this revamped talks?
Our expectation is we go to a consensus to the topics on the table. Constitution of 1922 at it were the original one, and the voting of the diaspora, the Togolese abroad. This is it. Also, we will talk about the institution, how we can run the institution, because so far it's not the case. So there is no specific move today, but the trend is everybody is very clear that the interest of Togo is the goal. So we are waiting.
But Kojo, there was a stalemate. That is why the talks fizzled out, and that is why President Nana Akufo-Addo of Ghana has to, return to Togo on Friday to help jump the stock. What happened?
Okay, you know, everybody is standing on his position. So Mr. Akufo-Addo is trying to push him, you know, to connect each of us in something acceptable. This is what he is doing. So we are waiting for the next session, coming session. We don't have any date already. We are not pessimistic about the outcome.
Some people are saying that the demand by the opposition that President Faure Gnassingbé steps down, even though he has won elections, is not fair, and that is what is causing the problem because of the insistence that he steps down.
Okay, even if the constitution is allowed him to run up to the term of the ongoing mandate, that doesn't mean there is no negotiation about how acceptable for both parties he could move out. I don't see anyone insisting on President Faure to resign today, but the point is on the table, okay? Realistically, we will move to that, to the end of the mandate. Maybe before, but we don't know.
So what are your expectations of the Ghanaian president in helping move this dialogue forward?
Okay, let me put it this way. We have a Ghanaian dimension in our Togolese problem. As the Ghanaian, they have a Togolese dimension in their problem. So the best way for Ghana to move forward is to press both parties, not only the opposition, but mainly the power in place now, to move in the right direction. If not, Ghana also will have something to do with some trouble in Togo. It's not good for them, even for Nigeria, for example. So let us wait for a good conclusion. As everyone in Togo, in Nigeria, in Ghana are thinking, this, the best way to deal with this is to be reasonable.
But will the opposition be reasonable? Will the opposition be reasonable? Because the government is, some supporters of the government are saying the opposition is not reasonable.
No, reasonable means we cannot be tied on the resignation of President Faure today. This is reasonable. So the party, I mean UNI, would not stand on staying in power up to, you know, eternity, for example. No, they will find a way to move out. In fact, we say par la grande porte. This is what we want for everybody. We don't want to be in the situation where Faure will kill everybody to stay in power, or we will kill Faure to move to power. We are not going to do that. We want something where everybody is alive and we greet everybody and we sing and dance after the victory of democracy in Togo, the triumph of democracy in Togo. That's what we want.
Kojo Marcos Dima is a leading member of the National Alliance for Change, or ANC, a Togolese opposition party. He spoke with me from the capital, Lome. Zambia's main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, has filed a motion in parliament seeking to impeach President Edgar Lungu. The party says it has obtained the signatures of one-third of the 167-member parliament who are in support of the motion. The UPND accuses Lungu of violating the constitution after he failed to hand over power to the Speaker of Parliament when the party filed a presidential petition. For an impeachment to succeed, the constitution requires two-thirds of parliamentarians to support the measure. For reaction, I read Sunday Chanda, media director for the ruling Patriotic Front Party, or PF, in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
The motion filed in by the opposition UPND in the attempt to impeach the president is a fraudulent motion. It's a flawed, and we can best describe it as a BID. It's a motion that is dead on arrival.
Zambia Constitution requires the support of two-thirds of the National Assembly members for such a proposal to succeed. Some are suggesting that that could happen with this motion. Your take?
It cannot happen. UPND, number one, does not have the numbers. Number two, there are UPND members who have stayed away from signing that petition of theirs, because we know that even within the UPND, there are men and women of good conscience who know for a fact that they will not be used to perpetuate Mr. Hakainde Hichilema's selfish quest for power, even after he's been rejected by the Zambian people in a democratic process for 5 times. And he knows that this is an attempt that he's going to lose once again. And once he has lost this motion to impeach the president, we are going to count it as the 6th time that he's losing to the Zambian people.
One of the motions they raised as the president's violation of the constitution is that the president failed to hand over power to the Speaker of the National Assembly when the presidential petition was filed. They said this is a flagrant contravention or violation of the constitution, which requires impeachment, and that is why they filed the motion in parliament. How do you respond to that?
The first question, Peter, that anyone would ask, any right-thinking citizen would ask is, even if assuming that were to be true, why did the UPND have to wait this long before they could file in that motion and raise that as a ground? But number two, they know very well that that argument does not hold water and it's not sound at law. That particular argument applies in circumstances when we have to go for a rerun, and that's when the speaker comes into the picture, and the constitution is very, very clear. We are not moved at all. We are not moved an inch by schemes and machinations by Mr. Hichilema to get into power through the back door. I can guarantee you, and we can guarantee the international community, we can tell the world that President Lungu is leader of the people of Zambia, and the House as it sits, Parliament as it sits, is looking at that motion, and they are laughing at that motion.
They said President Edgar Lungu has amassed unprecedented personal wealth and assets within the short period that he's been president. And they said this on its own, it's grounds for impeachment as well.
You see, that's the pettiness. And I can tell you that all that is propaganda that is generated by a UPND propaganda social media site called The Watchdog and The Zambian Observer. Now, that is political junk. And they know for a fact that President Lungu can account for his worth. And they're not dealing with someone who's just come from the blues. You are dealing with someone who has represented serious cases in this country. And so when they raise what they raise, we laugh at them. We don't take that seriously because Mr. Hakainde Hichilema cannot account for his wealth. We can account for what we have.
Now, let me ask you this, Sunday.
If you ask him today how much money did he make by his association with the privatization exercise in this country, he's not going to answer you that question.
There are speculation in the local media that the president is sick, and his recent trip to South Africa to meet Cyril Ramaphosa, his colleague, is just a pretext to seek medical attention while there.
I can guarantee you, Peter, the president is very fit. The president is as fit as a fiddle. The president runs, he covers 11 kilometers every morning 4 times in a week. That is no child's play. And that is a man who's above 60. That is no child's play. The distances the president covers when he's doing his jogging in the morning, when he's running in the morning, those distances, not even Hakainde Hichilema can manage them. He can't even do a quarter of the distances President Lungu runs in the morning. And I can tell you that the UPND has been and will always be laughed at by the Zambian people because they celebrate misfortune and they are hoping that this time around President Lungu is unwell, and because if they think that he's unwell and if their prayers were to be true, then it would be easier for them to get to power. We are saying to them that this is the more reason why Zambians continue to associate some of these opposition political parties with dark forces.
Sunday Chanda is the media director for the Zambian ruling Patriotic Front Party, or PF. He spoke with me from Lusaka.
Hello! This is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat.
whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the recent meeting between Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta and opposition leader Raila Odinga seems to have cooled down the political heat. To find out whether the rapprochement between the two leaders has impacted the livelihoods of their supporters, my colleague Douglas Mpuga reached Samuel Atandi, a member of parliament for Alego Usonga and a member of the opposition NASA coalition.
The coming together of His Excellency the President of the Republic of Kenya and His Excellency the Right Honorable Raila Amolo Odinga has resulted in so many immediate benefits to the Kenyan economy. The Kenya shilling has stabilized against the US dollar. There has been stability in our stock market, and generally the political climate has calmed down substantially. The country and the people have embraced each other in a way that was not happening before.
Now, talking of the economy, does this mean that the opposition's boycott of certain products associated with some members of the government, has that boycott been called off?
Yes, the boycott was called off. You know, the NASA coalition had embarked on a process of reclaiming their electoral victory, which was snatched away from them by the ruling Jubilee coalition. One of the things we had started to do was the convention of the People's Assembly, which, you know, had been going around across the country, and where people are making a resolution on a number of issues. And that one also, we had to call that off. And the boycott of the various products of companies that we stopped facilitated the electoral theft. Also, that one also we stopped. And basically, in terms of National Assembly, as members of the NASA coalition, we were not participating in the activities of government, such as the vetting of cabinet secretaries, and basically participating in the substantial motions that were going to facilitate the operations of government. We are now participating in those major processes of government, including budget processes, and this has brought a lot of changes in the way the country operates. It has also given the investors a lot of confidence in the economy, and Kenya basically is working positively.
As you say, there seems to be a coming together among the leadership, the principals and you people who are at the top. How far have you gone or trying to do to heal the rift between the people themselves?
You see, once the leaders met and made a statement together, the country began to heal itself. One of the epicenters of political dissent against this government is Kisumu County, Kisumu City. And Kisumu City has now embraced the government. They are even ready to welcome, to receive the President of the Republic of Kenya. And they have asked the NASA leader, His Excellency Raila Amolo Odinga, to invite the President to visit Kisumu. So basically, the meeting of the two leaders has been embraced by Kenyans across the board.
The major contention was some reforms that were demanded by you people in the opposition. Are there steps being taken to work on those reforms?
Yes, the two leaders have made an agreement to move the country forward, to unite the country, to bring everybody together in the process of governance so that Kenya can be one. And one of the things that they must do is that they must bring real reconciliation. They must also ensure that the national resources are distributed across the board in a manner that every Kenyan is able to appreciate. The other thing that they have also undertaken to do is to ensure that in terms of distribution of national positions in government, that an audit is going to be undertaken where we are going to ensure that each and every community in Kenya is represented in national leadership, national positions. But what we have said is that because what really brought these issues is the fact that the electoral process appeared not to be fair, not to be free and fair. And that for this healing process to go on in a way that Kenyans will appreciate, then we must also be able to reform certain institutions. One of the institutions that we must reform is the National Police Service. You know, the police has been used to maim and to kill political opponents and people who are not supporting the regime in power. So that one must be reformed. Then electoral system must also be reformed so that in future we have an electoral body that will conduct an electoral process where people will be satisfied and they will move on. So Kenya must heal this process where in every election there must be a crisis. This can only be healed if we sincerely reform the electoral system and have an electoral body that will be able to embrace free and fairness and credibility in their process.
Samuel Atandi is a Kenyan member of parliament. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Egypt is mediating continuous talks between Libyan military officials to unify the Libyan military establishment. But a recent meeting of Libyan mayors in Tripoli expressed concern that unifying the military first might lead to a military takeover of the executive branch. Mufta Al-Tayar is a former Libyan ambassador to Mexico. He explained to viewers Mohamed El-Shenawi the complicated political landscape in Libya that could result in different scenarios.
I might say none of the above. The meeting in Egypt, the final press release was not strong, was not convincing. It's true that the attendance was high level from both sides. Looks like it is symbolic more than anything else. To unify the military in Libya, which could lead to one of either step you mentioned, have to be preceded by specific steps. The landscape right now in Libya is very complicated and more than to be solved by a meeting to unify the army, while in fact there are other powers on the ground more organized, more armed than the army itself. I am looking at it as a thing, as symbolic more than anything else.
In Tripoli, the capital hosted a meeting of Libyan mayors in which mayors insisted that unifying the executive authority should precede unifying the army. Is that a better way for Libya?
The statement itself in itself is noble and welcomed by the Libyans. The meeting you are referring to is the second one. The first one was last year in the eastern part of Libya in a city called Shahat. The press release contained three recommendations. The first one is insisting on the unity of the Libyan land and the Libyan country. And with that is try to hard work on improving the well-being of the citizens in Libya. The second recommendation talk about forming a committee, help both the parliament in the east and in the west to come up with a solution toward getting us out of this. The third one, which is the important one, is that if this failed, then they have recommended that you return the authority to the Supreme Court, which had 1 year to have to pace the road for an election in Libya after they choose a government. Any effort that could lead us toward an exit from this pass, which we have been installed in, is welcomed by the Libyans. But remember, these are the mayors, and it depends how other parties are welcoming and supporting their effort.
Observers cited a big obstacle facing a political solution in Libya, which is Eastern Libyan camp in Benghazi, pushing for elections before drafting a constitution, while the Western Libyan camp in Tripoli insisting on a constitution first. Could that be reconciled between the two sides?
It's not impossible, but however, let us begin with that the elections is becoming a very popular demand in Libya, and Libyans are putting so many hopes on it to get them out of this mess. But it's not easy. It's true that Libyans are in a desperate situation, but to have an election, to begin with, the great obstacle right now against this is stability, which is also is threatened. This stability is threatened by the local militia, foreign intervention, and sometimes foreign silence of some powers. Yesterday, the Human Rights Watch released a press release about the difficulty of having election right now. Of course, to have an election law or amendment, the second law, is important. But both of them need a constitutional recognized internationally entity to do that.
That was former Libyan ambassador to Mexico, Muftar Al-Tayar. He spoke with viewers Mohammed El-Shenawi from California. This week, Rwanda hosted the 10th Extraordinary Summit of the African Union. Its crowning achievement was an agreement to create a Continental Free Trade Area, or CFTA. The deal is expected to double the share of inter-African trade by 2022. 44 countries have already signed the agreement. William Awinador Kanyerige is Ghana's ambassador to Ethiopia. For VOA, he spoke with reporter Eugene Uwumana for further explanations.
Basically, what is going to happen is that with this larger African space, I mean, if you want to add value to your products, I mean, and you look at your neighbors and the market size that it affords you. So it kind of enhances the profit margins based on the large market size. That is, if we are able to go beyond the narrow domestic market. So definitely, if you look at the population of Africa alone, that is huge. What we need now is that our private sector and civil society, in particular media, need to also get more involved.
How will this deal help with employment?
Basically, what is going to happen is that when you create opportunities for business like this, in other words, you are creating jobs as well.
And what happens after the signing on March 21st? What next?
Yeah, so what is going to happen is that there are a number of key things to do. There are certain outstanding aspects of the annex protocols which still need to be negotiated. They are not complete. So that will continue. That is one. Two, those countries that have not yet signed, there will be effort for them to also come on board because some of them are not ready. That's why you haven't seen them sign. It's not because they don't want to sign. And then thirdly, very critical, is the issue of sensitization. Our private sector and civil society have not yet been involved as they should. Many of them don't even know that there is something like this going on. This is where the media has a critical role to play. Last then will be ratification. Again, the sensitization should also speak to the issue of ratification so that the necessary domestic processes can be fast-tracked. For us to, as you know, the leaders have agreed that when 22 countries ratify, then automatically it enters into force.
And how will FSFTA impact trade and other sectors inside and outside Africa, or development in general?
Well, basically, because of the opportunities it's going to unlock, which includes innovation, value addition and all that, it also will sharpen our competitiveness with the outside world. And that goes without saying. And I can imagine that by now the outside world is watching Africa closely because Africa will readjust, and they also have to readjust in this globalized system of exchanges. So these are going to be very exciting times, not just for Africa, but for the entire world.
Do you see any potential challenges to the implementation of these agreements?
Naturally, there will be challenges moving forward. So definitely there will be challenges in terms of readjustment, because this is about change. You are going to have to change, first of all, mindset is critical, and changing of mindset is not an easy one. Education, we need to invest in our people to be able to develop the necessary skills to take advantage of these huge opportunities, and that will require also further investment.
Does this duplicate or enhance the role of regional blocs like COMESA or East African Community or ECOWAS?
Absolutely not. The regional blocs are building blocks of this process. So what is going to happen is that the regional blocs will now naturally blend with this integrated continental arrangement. So it doesn't at all. We don't expect the regional blocs to be ending themselves. They are meant to be building blocks.
Does this agreement help establish a base for other economic or political agreements across the continent?
What I do know is that this agreement is going to unlock a lot of opportunities. When you are able to cooperate in the economic, you cooperate better in the political. When you cooperate better in the political, you cooperate better in the economic and cultural. So they kind of intertwine and enhance each other.
Ambassador William Awinador Kanyerige is the Ghanaian ambassador to Ethiopia. For VOA, he spoke with reporter Eugene Uwimana from the Rwandan capital, Kigali. And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Ha! Kimbiza, ona papio mamio, wote wanakulilia. Mtoto peke yako nyumbani, kipi kimekukimbiza? Ona papio mamio, wote wanakulilia. Ndani ya Dar es Salaam, ulikuja bure, tena kimwana, kimwana, hujui kuchuna. Na zile lawama za wale, walokuzoeza, ulikuja jana, na leo, tofauti sana.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sale, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, when the door is closed, you must learn to slide across the crack of the sail. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Angola is one of the world's most heavily mined countries. Decades of fighting for independence, followed by a quarter century of civil war that ended in 2002, left the country in tatters and heavily sown with landmines. During the civil war, both sides liberally deployed landmines to protect military bases, key infrastructure and troop billets, and to control the population's movement. Benguela province is one of the country's most mine-affected regions. Half the population lives in rural areas, where the vast majority of explosive remnants of war are found. It is one of the reasons why development has stagnated there. Unemployment is high. Some 94% of the population lives on less than $5 per day, with 67% surviving on less than $2 per day. Halo Trust, a non-political and non-religious British charity and American non-profit organization which specializes in removal of debris left behind by war, has found a way to address both these issues and more. Its 100 Women in Mining in Angola project, which is supported by the U.S. Department of State, trains and employs women deminers to clear some of the most dangerous minefields in the country. Ultimately, the project assists in creating safe spaces for rural development that benefit Benguela's mine-impacted populations. But the program's benefits reach far beyond clearing the land of mines. The work teaches the women new skills, provides them with income, and empowers them. The project specifically promotes gender equality in employment, offering women opportunities in geographical areas and sectors of the economy that have traditionally been male-dominated. All positions at all levels are open to the women, ranging from basic manual demining to logistic, medical, and technical support personnel, team leaders, minefield supervisors, and a provincial operations manager to oversee the entire operation. As the majority of the recruits come from the local districts, the project allows them to take a central role in the stabilization and development of their home communities. When local women have a say in how mine clearance operations are conducted, they have a chance to be involved in shaping outcomes for themselves, their families, their communities, and their country as a whole.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
From Washington.